I am providing more follow-up to the May 2019 American Bar Association tax section meeting, and I am focusing today on the United States Tax Court, their appearances at the ABA tax meeting, the announcement they made, and various panels that they appeared on.
Welcome to Tax Justice Warriors, the podcast that celebrates the work of low-income taxpayer clinics, focuses on tax controversy work, and looks at related issues in tax news. I'm your host, William Schmidt, the director of the Low-Income Taxpayer Clinic at Kansas Legal Services.
There wound up being a good amount of attendance at the American Bar Association 2019 May tax section meeting in Washington, D.C. by the United States Tax Court judges. I spoke with Judge Paris between panels on the Friday afternoon, but various of the other judges I saw either as panelists or they were in the audience at different panels that I attended. To begin with, on the Thursday afternoon in the low-income taxpayer representation workshop within the self-employed and the online platform economy, navigating earned income tax credit audits from tax return to tax court, that special trial judge Diana Layden was one of the panelists at that panel. I may not be able to hit all of the panels that they were on, but within the Individual and Family Taxation Committee on the Friday morning, the panel that I was a part of, the collection due process beyond the weeping and gnashing of teeth, what can be done to fulfill CDP's beneficial intent. Judge Gustafson was one of the panelists, and in attendance were Judges Carluzzo, Layden, and Panuthos. I'm going to talk in more depth about the collection due process panel next week and give some feedback on that. So I'm going to turn next to a panel at 3 o'clock on that Friday afternoon, simply titled Current Developments. And the focus was, it was within the Court Procedure and Practice Committee. The panel included Chief Judge Maurice Foley of the U.S. Tax Court. And within that panel, they announced the press release regarding limited entries of appearance. I'm going to finish this episode talking in depth about those, but Chief Judge Foley said that those limited entries of appearance were due to Judges Layden and Panuthos. Then going through the panel, there was a discussion of the Hackish case, and I noticed that that was in yesterday's procedurally taxing, so Tuesday, May 28, 2019, Keith Fogg did a examination of Hackish v. Commissioner, but as a summary, they had used a private delivery service during the government shutdown to file their petition with the tax court. That was an authorized private delivery service, and they used FedEx. FedEx attempted several deliveries to the tax court, who apparently did not understand about the government shutdown, that no one was going to receive the mailing during that time, and somehow it wound up in Mississippi. Well, it was sent back to Washington, D.C. It wound up being late. It was not sent by an approved service when it was received, but the IRS did not move to dismiss the case, and the tax court had submitted an order for them to show cause why it should not be dismissed. The petitioners had their receipt for how they had originally submitted their petition during the government shutdown, and the case was not dismissed. Within the audience at that panel, I noticed Judges Panuthos, Judge Book, Judge Layden, and Judge Carluzzo. I'm going to mention that on the Saturday morning, within the Pro Bono and Tax Clinic Committee, that Judge Carluzzo was a panelist on the nuts and bolts of a successful pro bono settlement day. I'm going to potentially do an in-depth focus on that panel, but next I'm going to turn to another panel, one that Friday afternoon Judge Carluzzo was also a panelist on, and that panel was from the Young Lawyers Forum, from the Young Lawyers Committee The title is Motions Practice in Tax Court from Pleadings to Post-Trial Proceedings. Now, the moderator was Josh Savey. Like I mentioned, panelist, Chief Special Trial Judge Louis Carluzzo. I may mispronounce her name, but Han Huang of IRS Counsel in Washington, D.C., and then Rebecca Stork. Those were the panelists. I mentioned previously that this was a very educational panel, so I am going to go through that one now. And also going to note that in the audience were Judges Marvel, Book, Panuthos, and Ashford. So overall, there was great attendance by U.S. tax court judges at the various panels. But going through the panel, Judge Carluzzo, and I will also mention here that he was very witty. He gave candid comments about what judges see within tax court. This panel looked at how motions were successful and what types of cases the motions often appear in. So Judge Carluzzo began by saying that docket status, until assigned to a judge, it may be some duplication of effort by different judges, and that often on these motions, the court may take action as it sees fit. For one thing, if there is a motion that requires some action, but it concerns a city that is outside Washington, D.C., then one question for the parties is, should there be a hearing in Washington, D.C. so that it is immediate, or do the parties want to wait until the calendar call? So do they want to favor immediacy, or do they want to favor the ease of going to a location that is closer to them rather than traveling to Washington, D.C.? So a judge will be assigned to the case until disposition of the motion. So there is one item to note is that it may be one judge is assigned for the motion and then a different judge is assigned for trial or other stages of the case. And if one of the judges says in deciding about the original motion that an item will be taken up later, then the second judge may or may not have the same view of the subject and may or may not want to actually deal with the fallout from that original motion in the same fashion. So there can be a little bit of strategy related to these motions, but it is something worth noting. Judge Carluzzo also said that the tax court may take an action within a case, just as if a party could when filing a motion. So if the court decides that action needs to be taken within the case, then they can take that upon themselves to do that action. And it would certainly file an order or something like that on their own. But a refrain that Judge Carluzzo had said is, the court may take action as it sees fit. The tax court is a court of notice pleading, while other courts are courts of plausibility pleading. I had actually asked if there is a difference between small cases and regular cases when it comes to the scope of discovery. He said that there was technically no difference, that the discovery is proportional to the scope of the case. Then turning to input from IRS counsel, when looking at a pro se taxpayer versus a represented taxpayer, that often means more restraint on the IRS side on how to deal with the case. And as I was saying earlier, that the judge may be different for the case at different times during the case. One example is that a judge on a motion to compel may be different than the trial judge. Judge Carluzzo mentioned that a conversation starter at one of the receptions could be that the court had four separate rules for discovery depositions at one time. So if you want to start a conversation about the U.S. tax court, there you go. A motion to quash a subpoena, that is an example of having to make a tough decision whether to have a hearing at the calendar call or in Washington, D.C. A motion to withdraw or modify admissions, it may be best to wait until a judge is assigned to the case, and those often should not happen with a represented party. A motion for a protective order, deals with confidential items within the case. So that could be seismic studies on minerals, trade secrets on patents, or whistleblower cases. Now, that is a difference between, it could be in a whistleblower case that some people just don't want their information on the internet. So that isn't necessarily a motion that would be granted, that if they're just wanting a little bit extra privacy when it comes to the public record for tax court. When looking at the motion for summary judgment, again, the question is that a genuine issue of material fact? Even if there is no issue, then a party should not win as a matter of law if there are no facts to render law or judgment. With oral arguments, again, this comes up whether to be in Washington or in the calendar call city. That is another judgmental question. A stipulation of facts could be used to dispute a motion for summary judgment. That Judge Gustafson likes separate factual assertions. You can do a partial motion for summary judgment. Some types of motion for summary judgment cases, that abuse of discretion, which is often in the collection due process, those receive more motion for summary judgments than a de novo for deficiency cases. Those make it partial motion for summary judgments. Submission of a case without a trial is routinely granted. Judge Ashford said that she prefers a conference call before hearing on the motion at calendar call. Judge Marvel mentioned buyer's remorse often happens in this kind of situations. Judge Carluzzo gave an example of fraud cases that it may not be disputed, but it would not fall under a motion for summary judgment that the party could submit it under Rule 122. Judge Carluzzo also said that what a judge likes the least is having to try the case twice. And I believe he was speaking about the motion to shift the burden, that first it is looking to see whether the burden is shifts and then actually having the trial. So the judge often does not like having to make those decisions more than once. The panel itself, I will say, was very instructional. It went through the various motions in depth, got good input from the different panelists, private practice, IRS counsel, and Judge Carluzzo, plus the judges within the audience. So I would recommend, if you are able to order the recording of that panel, certainly do so. Next, I'm going to turn to the limited entries of appearance. Within the administrative order number 2019-01, as part of the background for limited entries of appearance, it does mention Rule 1.2C of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct of the American Bar Association. That permits limited representation. And Rule 201A of the Tax Court Rules of Practice and Procedure provides that practitioners before the tax court shall carry on their practice in accordance with the letter and spirit of the Model Rules of the American Bar Association. So in that sense, the tax court is aligning with the American Bar Association's model rules regarding limited representation. So practitioners admitted to practice and in good standing with the tax court may file a limited entry of appearance. They are to use the form that is attached to the administrative order during a scheduled trial session. The practitioner may limit their appearance to a date or dates during a scheduled trial session. The practitioner must file with the court a separate limited entry of appearance in each case. So if the practitioner wants to appear in multiple cases, then they have to use multiple forms, and they can choose to do one specific day or multiple days within the calendar call. But yes, I will go on that the limited entry of appearance form must be executed by the practitioner, contain an executed acknowledgement by the petitioners, and be served on all parties or their counsel. The form may not be filed earlier than the start of a scheduled trial session, and it automatically terminates at the earlier of the adjournment of the trial session or the end of the date or dates specified in the limited entry of appearance. So in essence, the practitioner will not be counsel for the petitioner beyond the calendar call session. So whether they have selected 1 or 2 days or did not specify specifically which days they are entering their appearance for, that limited entry of appearance will terminate at the end of the trial session, which could be up to a work week in actuality. That if the petitioner wants to seek termination of the limited appearance at a date earlier than that indicated in the filed limited entry of appearance, they must ask the court for leave to withdraw, and the judge has the same ability to decide whether to grant that leave to withdraw or to terminate the practitioner's appearance earlier than that described in the limited entry of appearance form. The service is only required during the time period set forth in the limited entry of appearance and must be made on the petitioner or petitioners, and does not extend the time of the practitioner's appearance if made outside the time period set forth in the limited entry of appearance. Procedure will take effect as of September 9, 2019, so we do have some months to understand the procedure before it will take effect. Within the frequently asked questions, the limited entry of appearance is different from the regular entry of appearance because the entry of appearance is limited and ends at the end of that calendar call trial session, while the entry of appearance is more indefinite and follows the routine procedure already set out within the tax court rules of practice and procedure, that it does not prevent someone who filed a limited entry of appearance to later file a standard entry of appearance, that the limited entry of appearance still means that a practitioner must still abide by the model rules of professional responsibility for the American Bar Association and the tax court rules of practice and procedure, that the limited entry of appearance is appropriate for the following circumstances: standing with the petitioners and speaking to the court on their behalf, requesting a continuance, or responding to a motion filed by the respondent. It is not necessary for talking with respondent's counsel about settlement with the petitioners. If you want to speak with the petitioners about their case, but not to respondent's counsel or to the court, then it is not necessary to file a limited entry of appearance. Now, again, I must note that Judge Foley thanked Judges Layden and Panuthos for setting up the limited entry of appearance, that I believe part of the reason for setting up the limited entry of appearance is for pro bono attorneys, whether they are appearing on behalf of the American Bar Association, other local bar associations, or just simply on their own, that this would allow them more comfort in appearing on behalf of a previously unrepresented petitioner, but they would not be required to appear for the petitioner as counsel beyond the dates that they have specified in the limited entry of appearance. Now, I wanted to turn also to the Low-Income Taxpayer Clinic. They have given guidance, the Low-Income Taxpayer Clinic administration, through our toolkit, that it says under the heading the limited appearance and LITC reporting considerations, when a clinic files a limited appearance for a taxpayer, it can be counted as a case for LITC reporting purposes. Since you may have a limited ability to verify a taxpayer's income before agreeing to provide limited representation, you will need to keep in mind the limited number of cases your clinic may accept over the 250% federal poverty level. A clinic is limited to 10% of the number of new cases opened during the year. Remember, however, there is no income limit for a taxpayer to whom a clinic provides a consultation. Consultations are counted separately from cases. As this new provision is implemented and utilized, please contact your assigned advocacy analyst with any questions you may have about LITC reporting. They also go on to say, kudos to the LITC clinicians, private bar members, and all others who helped bring about this exciting change in tax court policy. It will allow many more low-income, unrepresented taxpayers to receive competent counsel and representation at tax court trial sessions across the country. So I wanted to note what this means in practice for LITC clinicians, that if the unrepresented petitioners are above our income limits, then doing a limited appearance will count as taking on a case above the income levels within our annual case reporting. So what does this mean? If the limited appearance looks to be good for a person below the income limits, then there is no problem doing a limited appearance at all. Though, in that instance, a clinician may want to file a regular entry of appearance. When it comes to the people who are over income, they may want to help them out, but should note that it would be over income and one of the cases that goes towards the limited cases that are over income. So they may not want to enter an appearance at all and only provide a consultation. Does this mean that LITC clinicians may not want to use limited appearances at all? That may be the case. It may be that pro bono practitioners who want to represent unrepresented petitioners within the tax court, that may be mostly for them. And again, that will help them out in providing assistance at the calendar calls for tax court. And it may not be meaning as much to the low-income taxpayer clinic community, but it is a good option for clinicians to consider in assisting unrepresented petitioners. It's just worth noting that for the people who are over income, that it may count toward those cases and not always something that they want to use. So overall, I hope you learned something from this about trial case practice before the tax court and the participation by tax court judges, both as panelists and audience members at the ABA May meeting for 2019. I think it was well worth interacting with them and hearing what they had to say. So thank you for tuning in. I hope you look forward to hearing about collection due process in my next episode. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Tax Justice Warriors. We have a Patreon page if you'd like to support this podcast. Providing monetary support for this podcast helps with expenses like equipment or travel to tax conferences. Supporting this podcast through Patreon comes with rewards, so check out our Patreon page. Please rate or review this podcast because positive reviews help get more people to know this podcast exists. The views expressed on this podcast are not official opinions of the IRS, the Low Income Taxpayer Clinic Program, or the employers of the people who spoke on this program. Your tax situation is unique, so do not take the statements on this program as tax or legal advice. Consult with your own tax professional to provide you with specific advice on your situation. Tune in next time on Tax Justice Warriors for another interesting tax discussion.